From WUWM Milwaukee Public Radio, this is Lake Effect. I'm Bonnie North. Today on the show, the newest quarterly Wisconsin Economic Scorecard is out, and we'll have a look at the numbers. Then, the story of a little-known witness to President Lincoln's death.
He lived next door, across the street from Ford's Theater, and when the president is shot in April 1865, they carry him across the street to the Peterson House, which is next door to Tanner's apartment.
Despite some recent setbacks, Tesla Motor Company pushes forward with the all-electric car.
It's fun to see somebody trying some new and different things that will ultimately spur the marketplace forward and then add some different models and some different capabilities as far as the battery range and so forth.
And we'll have the next installment of our weekly series, The Islands of Milwaukee. Lake Effect comes your way next. News is first. This is Lake Effect from Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Bonnie North. Thanks so much for tuning in today. The Center for Urban Initiatives and Research at UW-Milwaukee is out with its latest Wisconsin Economic Scorecard. That's the quarterly survey of how residents believe the state is faring. This poll shows support for investing in green energy and opposition for public funding for a new Bucks Arena. And it gives a mixed but improving picture of residents' finances and attitudes about the state's economy. Survey manager Joseph Serra shared the poll's highlights with WUWM's Annalise Hensel.
You know, when it comes to economic evaluations, I think it really starts with the economy that people experience for themselves. And for quite a while now, the state has been pretty split between people who say that their personal financial situations are good or excellent, and then there are people who say that their personal situations are fair or poor. It's been a pretty even split, and things haven't really changed much over the last 2 years. But it's not just personal situations. People see what's going on around them as well. And another trend that we've seen over the last 2 years, which continues this quarter, is just incremental improvements in what people think about the overall state economy. So most people say that the state economy is bad, or at least not good, but the proportion of people who say that the state economy is good is slowly increasing. That's continued this quarter.
What are some of the factors that you look at when gauging how people feel about the economy? What types of questions do you ask?
Well, I mean, first we flat out ask, how do you evaluate your own situation? And then we say, we ask them what they think about the state generally. But then we also ask some specific questions about personal economic problems that people have had. So we ask about, have you had any problems paying your rent or mortgage? Have you had any problems with your utilities, affording your utilities? Have you had any problems saving or paying for retirement? Things of that nature. And we ask people about their spending on entertainment and recreation over the recent past and whether or not they think that they're going to increase that.
As we're heading into the summer, are people saying that they have a lot of extra money to spend on outdoor activities, vacations, concerts, things like that?
We ask people to characterize their spending in terms of how they've done it in the past most of the time. So people have tended to say over the last couple of years that they're spending less than they did in the past. But, the majority of people tend to say that they're spending less now than they had before. But at the same time, that proportion of people who say that they're spending less, that has slowly continued to shrink over the last 2 years as the economy has slowly improved.
Are there any categories that had really surprising answers to you?
One thing that surprises me is that people's evaluations of their own situations have really remained stable. But at the same time, people have been slowly expressing the view that things are getting better in the state overall.
What do you think accounts for that?
It's really hard to say. It could be something as simple as just hearing on the news that economic indicators are improving, or just less talk about, recession or depression. But it could be that just people just have a sense that the job market is improving, even if it hasn't impacted them specifically yet. And it's not just the economy. Another thing is that the proportion of people who say that the state is headed in the right direction overall is basically at the highest level that we've seen since we've been running the poll. And almost 60% of people say that the state's headed either strongly or somewhat in the right direction.
Well, the next thing that I wanted to ask you about is directly related to what you just mentioned, this idea of the state heading in the right direction. This is an election year, and candidates for office often build their campaigns around whether voters should retain them because the incumbents have been doing a good job and the state is headed in the right direction, or whether voters should vote for an opponent because they're unhappy with incumbents. Are you able to read anything into the results with respect to whether incumbents or challengers should feel pretty good right now?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, there's a lot we can say. So we break down the results by party as well. We look at people's party affiliation. And when an election is approaching, what you always see and what we see this quarter are partisans, they become polarized in terms of their opinion about the state economy and the direction of the state. So you see that every time that happened this quarter. But what's really telling is that independents right now are increasingly saying that the state is headed in the right direction and that the economy is improving. And that's, frankly, good news for incumbents.
There was one question that you asked that people from all stripes appear to support, and that's an increase in the minimum wage. Could you talk about that?
Sure. You know, there have been a lot of surveys at the state level and at the national level about this issue, and every survey says the same thing, that large majorities of people are in favor of increasing the minimum wage, and Wisconsin's no exception. So we've asked about this for a few quarters in a row now, and every time about 75%, 76%, 77% of people say that they would support an increase of the minimum wage. What's interesting, I think, is about this survey is that we asked people a follow-up question, an open-ended follow-up question. We said, in your opinion, what should the minimum wage be in Wisconsin? And then people were free to say, you know, whatever level that they wanted. Well, the most common answer right off the bat, the most common answer was $10 an hour. About a quarter of respondents said that they'd like to see the minimum wage raised to $10 an hour. But there were substantial numbers of people who wanted rates below that. A lot of people said $9 an hour. A few people said $8. And there were definitely a good 14% or so of people who said that they wanted to see it, you know, stay around where it is. So the median answer ends up being about $9 an hour.
You also asked respondents about several specific issues, and I'd like to ask you about them. One was whether the public should be involved in supporting a new basketball arena for the Milwaukee Bucks. Talk about that question and what the answers were.
We asked people all around the state, would you support spending state funds on the development of a new arena for the Milwaukee Bucks? And what we found is that, you know, the vast majority of registered voters in the state, 73%, said that they would not support spending state funds on a new arena. And we also broke it down by region. So we looked at people in the 5-county metro Milwaukee region. And although support is a little bit higher, the majority, 63%, still say that they're not in support of spending public funds on a new arena.
Had you asked this question before?
We asked a similar question last year. We have a similar set of questions. We asked about more specific proposals, not just state funds, but we said, how likely are you to support, say, increased sales tax to support either a revamping or construction of a new arena for the Bucks? And, you know, then people were against that. So it's not a surprise that opinion on this issue hasn't changed.
Conversely, there was a lot of support for a different question that you asked about renewable energy.
Yes. We asked whether or not the state should increase, decrease, or maintain its current efforts to incorporate more renewable energy. So right now, just under 10% of electrical energy generated by the state comes from renewable sources. And, the state is trying to increase that. It's on track to meet its goal of having 10% by the end of the year. But when asked about this, Wisconsin voters overwhelmingly say that Wisconsin should be doing more to increase its efforts to incorporate more renewable energy sources. Almost 70% of voters say that they'd like to see that. And, about a quarter of voters are okay with it. And just around 5, 6, 7% people think that we're spending too much time trying to get renewable energy sources in the mix.
And talk a little bit about what people said when it comes to public investment in transportation funding.
Sure. So this there's a projected shortfall in the state's transportation fund, and there's been a lot of discussion over the last year among policymakers about how we should go about dealing with that. And there are a bunch of options. We could have tax and user fee increases, could delay major road construction projects, could introduce toll roads or borrow money or a mix of those options. Last year, we asked people about each specific proposal, and it turns out that pretty much every one of those proposals is pretty unpopular. So we tried just presenting voters in the state with all of them and saying, which of these do you prefer and which do you find the most distasteful? And it turns out that people are generally in favor of, when they're presented with all the options, they're in favor of delaying road projects and they're in favor of introducing toll roads. And they're really against borrowing money. And there's also a substantial amount of people who, even though it's a popular option among one section of the electorate in the state, a lot of people really don't like the idea of toll roads. So toll roads are a very polarizing option, but they're definitely a viable option for a lot of people.
Joseph Serra is director of the Center for Urban Initiatives and Research at UWM. He talked with Annalise Hensel from the WUWM newsroom about the center's just-released poll on the state's economy. The Wisconsin Economic Scorecard is a quarterly survey of 569 state residents. The random sample was reached by landline and by mobile phone. The poll has a margin of error of plus or minus 4%, and you can find a link to the full results on our website, wuwm.com/lakeeffect. Time now for our weekly segment, The Islands of Milwaukee.
Welcome to the Islands of Milwaukee.
This is Maureen Towie from the Islands of Milwaukee. This week, we highlight our community partner, Stoll Associates, who provide care management for people in their homes. We spoke with Stoll co-founder, Phyllis Brostoff, who has worked with older adults for over 30 years. She tells us about what is changing in the field and what remains the same.
The older people live, the more likely they are to get a debilitating neurological condition. The most typical one being like dementia, you know, Alzheimer's or something like that. But there's a hell of a lot of other neurological conditions out there, which I don't think we saw much of back in the day. When I was in graduate school in 1968 to 1970, I took a whole course in, you know, basically public health and social work, and in which you went through all these different conditions and where's the social work role and these things and that. You know, there was very little on these neurological conditions. I just think it's because people are living longer and therefore more things are coming up that are deteriorations in your brain, which really didn't show up earlier because, you know, people died of something else earlier. You know, I think that one thing that hasn't changed is people's commitments to their families. You know, that was true 30 years ago, 40 years ago, and it continues to be true. People will go way beyond the call of duty if they possibly can. And then they, if they really, for some reason, can't do it anymore, that's when they go to outside help.
We've had some great experiences working with the caregivers from Stoll. They've been very open to adding storytelling, movement, and creative expression to their caregiving work. Like the Islands of Milwaukee, Stoll Associates is working to create a more connected community as we age. Thanks for listening.
You can participate in the Islands of Milwaukee project by calling the Islands hotline. It's 414-678-1653. You can also visit islandsofmilwaukee.org. Coming up next, a new book examines the life of an influential but now mostly forgotten Civil War veteran. We'll chat with the author when Lake Effect returns on Milwaukee Public Radio. This is Lake Effect on WUWM. I'm Bonnie North. The history of the Civil War is filled with familiar names, military leaders who planned and executed battles, war heroes, and political leaders from the Union and the Confederacy. But the war altered the lives of thousands of otherwise ordinary Americans. James Tanner was a teenager who fought briefly in the Civil War and was seriously injured. But it was his career in civil service after the war that was extremely well known at the time, but is almost entirely forgotten today. History writer James Martin believes it's a story worth knowing. His new book is called America's Corporal, James Tanner in War and Peace. Martin, who's chair of the history department at Marquette University, spoke with Lake Effect's Mitch Tyke.
Another book came out a couple of years ago about Civil War veterans in general. And I guess I encountered Tanner first as a caricature, the humor magazine Puck. I hated Civil War pensions or the abuse of Civil War pensions. And Tanner was kind of the lightning rod for criticism for a long time. And at one point, they ran a couple of front page, full color cartoons of him. And one of them is of Tanner standing in front of the U.S. Treasury with a long cornucopia snaking back into the building. He's got like a Roman toga on, which was interesting because he didn't have two legs. He had lost both legs. And he's just throwing money out to his grasping hands. And that was really the first time I'd heard his name. I saw a few other things too because he was a pretty prominent veteran. And after I finished the bigger book, I'd never done a biography before, and an opportunity came to write this book for a series at the University of Georgia Press, which is meant to be kind of untold stories, shorter books with a good storyline. And so that's how I came across them.
Well, and this seems like it was something of a challenge, at least as you would expect for most people who came of age in the middle of the 19th century. It does not seem that there was a lot of contemporaneous writing about his early life. What do we know about him in the days before the Civil War?
Not very much. I mean, he was very young. He was 16 when the war started. We know that he had a more education than most because he was still in school, according to the census, in 1860 when he was would have turned 16 that year.
And this is in upstate New York.
Right, right, west of Albany. And he was a school teacher, at least part-time, and that's about it.
So he joined the Union cause at 16. From your writing, it sounds like what we do know is that his family didn't especially want him to do that.
His father was reluctant for him to go. I don't think the father seemed to be very supportive of the war effort, but his son was underage, and he had to get his father's permission to go, although he did kind of run away and then came back and got the permission later on. He came from a very democratic part of New York, and so one of the points I make is that he enlists in a regiment that really is being assembled in Brooklyn and New York City, not in Schoharie County, and I think it's because the area is very democratic and not particularly interested in the war for a long time.
His war service was pretty short, pretty uneventful, until the incident that shaped much of the rest of his life.
As far as I can tell, he never fired his gun in anger. He was certainly on campaign several times. He had a little adventure in which he went out into the woods and captured a runaway Confederate or something at one point. That was kind of unclear. But yeah, he sort of witnessed the war without really being a part of it until this day on a hillside and he lost both legs.
What was medical care like for wounded veterans in those days?
As bad as you can imagine it. He had a particularly bad time in that he was captured. This is the Battle of Second Manassas. And it results in a pretty much a rout of the Union Army. And so he's wounded about the time his part of the line is collapsing. He's not even in the line. He's behind the line when he's hurt. They carry him to a sort of a farmhouse that is a makeshift shelter at least, not really a hospital. And there are 100, 120 other guys there who can't be moved. And so he's actually in Confederate hands for about 10 days with very little care. And so, you know, they dress his legs were amputated below the knee. He is basically unattended. He gets extraordinarily bad bed sores and infection in his back that almost kills him. In fact, the legs don't kill him. The back is much worse.
Right. He describes the darkest time of his life as being when they had to pour basically hydrochloric acid
on his back.
Yeah.
Yeah, without any sort of anesthesia. And he gets through, you know, he's in the hospital about 6 weeks after that, after he's exchanged for other Confederates, and goes home and learns how to walk.
He learns how to walk and he learns a bunch of other stuff too. How did he go about reintegrating himself into society as the war was winding down?
Well, very quickly. I think by the end of this is early fall 1862 is when he's injured. By early 1863, he's learned stenography or shorthand.
He basically goes off to business school in Syracuse.
Yeah, exactly. I think he did go there. This was also a correspondence course, but he seemed to actually have attended school in Syracuse. Then he goes back to Washington and gets a job in the War Department. Now, he's kind of back and forth. He also works at Albany during the legislative sessions. He's already kind of getting involved in politics. And as a disabled veteran, he's taking jobs that were reserved for them by middle of the war and afterwards as well.
Well, and the most remarkable story from this part of his life is that he was apparently in the room as President Lincoln died, or so it seems.
Yeah, no one really suggests he wasn't. He lived next door or across the street from Ford's Theater. And when the president is shot in April 1865, they carry him across the street to the Peterson House, which is next door to Tanner's apartment. Edwin Stanton, the Secretary of War, begins taking testimony immediately after the shooting, and they need a stenographer. And somebody in the room knows Tanner lives next door. And again, Tanner's working in the War Department, so there is a network that he's a part of. And he comes over, and from about 10 or 11 that night till about 5 in the morning, he's taking notes in shorthand for the Secretary of War. And as he's finishing up, the small group is gathering around Lincoln's deathbed, and he kind of wanders into the room and watches him die.
And but for the grace of God, would have been able to write down exactly Lincoln's last words. But it turns out
it was the chaplain's last words, actually. But his pencil was broken, so he couldn't do it. He does correct. Stanton has a very famous "Now he belongs to the ages" line that he says, and for a time it was thought he said "Now he belongs to the angels." But Tanner, no one knew Tanner was there until he became famous, and he really didn't make much of it until he was famous. And so
he's actually airbrushed out of all the images,
exactly, yeah,
if you will.
And a lot of people are brushed into the images as well, but some of the sketches seem to be accurate in terms of who's there, and he's not. But he corrects this longstanding mistake. His notes are kind of a famous document the Union League Club in Philadelphia has now. And as people were dying off, they commemorate Lincoln's assassination. So this is the second and last person who was in the room when Lincoln died. When he was the last one, it was actually Robert Lincoln, Lincoln's son, and Tanner were the last two. They were about the same age, I suppose.
Right, in their early 20s.
Yeah, yeah.
So Tanner takes up law. He settles in Brooklyn for a time. How does he end up connected to national politics besides, you know, having been sort of around them in Washington during the war?
Well, he joins the Grand Army of the Republic, which is the sort of the American Legion for Civil War soldiers. He is clearly quite political from the very beginning because he's never not involved. I mentioned earlier that he's working for the legislature on and off, you know, as he's reading for the law back in Schoharie. He is quite a speaker. He's a gregarious guy. He likes to be in politics. And then he starts having – he has a job in the Customs House. Then he's the tax collector for Brooklyn, which are very – they're appointed positions, but they're very political. And that's his entree, I think, into it. So as a veteran, as a Republican, he's sort of at the right time and place.
Well, and he winds up getting a pretty plum job in the Harrison administration, Pension Commissioner of the United States.
Which is one of the biggest jobs in the government at the time.
Well, and so what was that? This is not a job that exists today in exactly this way. What was that job responsible for?
All of the pensions being given out to veterans and their widows and orphans and other family members. This is 1889 is when he's appointed to this position. By this time, pensions are the single largest item in the federal budget, and they'll stay that way for quite a while. He has thousands of employees that he's responsible for, a massive operating budget. They give out $40 million a year or so in pensions.
Which is a lot of money in those days.
A lot of money. It's a lot of money now, I think, but it was a lot of money for the federal government then. There's a brand new building. He's sort of in charge of the which is now the National Building Museum.
It's a beautiful building.
It's gorgeous, red brick building, and it's a massive job. It's not quite cabinet level. He doesn't have anything to do with policymaking otherwise, but it's a bigger job than most cabinet level positions.
And he was not what you would call an unqualified success in that job, was he?
He was not. He's fired for 6 months. He resigns, but he's fired. He gets into tiffs with the Secretary of the Interior is his boss at the time. And over appointments, he kind of cleans out a lot of the former Democratic administrators. He has a very generous pension policy, including re-rating, they called them. So people already getting pensions could apply to have a higher pension if their condition worsened. He actually got his re-rated several times because of his legs. And no one ever really suggested he personally was corrupt, but there seemed to be corruption or at least abuse within the system. And this is a chronic thing that opponents complain about for many years, but he became a scapegoat for it.
Well, and how would you compare the debate over pensions for war veterans to the current state of affairs regarding the VA?
Well, that's a really good point. I mean, I'll mention a difference right now. Opponents of pensions would focus on the fact that many of the men getting pensions probably didn't deserve them. Either they had not really served hard, had hard service. They were coffee coolers and, as they were called, behind-the-lines guys who had gotten sick since the war. And in fact, the pension law was changed several times. Early on, you had to prove that your disability was a direct result of your war service. By 1889, or so, it was you just had to be a disabled soldier. And eventually old age can become a disability. And so 500,000 men are on the pension by the 1890s. That seemed excessive to opponents. And the Democratic Party tended to be the party that opposed them. And they really took it out on the soldiers. And so the things they would say about the veterans and the things they would say with the GAR associating with veterans that were somehow abusing their rights and this privilege were pretty incredible. And you'll never hear that today talking about veterans.
The country as a whole did not necessarily have the attitude that we as a society owed a debt of gratitude to them.
There was a certain debt of gratitude, but they didn't want to monetize it. You know, there were also soldiers' homes, of course. Milwaukee had one of the first federal soldiers' homes overlooking Miller Park. Those weren't really controversial, and those were very much the worst off men. They weren't necessarily completely disabled, but they couldn't take care of themselves for whatever reason. And they were not very expensive. They weren't huge. Maybe 5% of veterans lived in them. The pension situation, however, was the biggest thing in the budget. And many opponents suggested that the Republican Party were keeping tariffs very high. Two very boring things, tariffs and pensions, come together here. But they are what made politics in the Gilded Age in many ways. But they accused the Republicans of keeping tariffs very high to pay for these pensions. And that was not a popular thing either.
So he's basically driven from office. He does not disappear, though. What were the prominent roles he played after being pension commissioner?
He continues advocating for pensions, partly because he is himself a claims agent. He made tens of thousands of dollars a year at the height of his career as a claims agent. He continues being a very prominent member of the GAR and a campaigner for Republican candidates. If you called on Tanner to campaign for you, and they did throughout the country, you knew he was going to mention the soldiers. He was there to get the soldiers to vote out, and one way to do that is to advocate for higher pensions. And this way the GAR becomes a bit of an auxiliary to the Republican Party, and the Republican Party is the biggest friend of the pension for Union soldiers.
We didn't mention that he was a corporal, and there's a significance to the fact that he was not a colonel or a major or a general.
Yeah, he has a really funny story about when he was first breaking into politics in Brooklyn, that they kept calling him colonel or captain or major, and he would never say that, and he always referred to himself as Corporal Tanner. And he finally set the record straight because he didn't want some opponent later on coming back and suggesting he had inflated his record. But certainly in the 20 years after the war, the people you would hear about writing about the war and talking about the war and leading veterans organizations and really being politicians were the officers, which is the certain logic to that, I suppose. They were leaders and they were prominent men already before the war. He's one of the very first common soldiers to become prominent in the GAR. He runs the New York GAR for 2 years in the 1870s, in his 30s. That's pretty unusual. And so it eventually becomes quite a strength of his to be Corporal Tanner as opposed to Colonel Tanner, I think. And he kind of outlasts the officers too because he was very, very young when the war was fought. But by the 1920s, the pension issue has declined. The GAR has declined in numbers, inevitably. The 1920s is kind of when a lot of newspapers were talking about the old soldiers, you know, passing away. And there were certainly thousands of them left by the time he died in 1927. But it was very bittersweet. So the issues that he would advocate weren't very important. He'd fallen out of the public eye. He'd been a really good story and a great quote for a lot of years. So newspapers would ask him about anything, World War I, the Germans, the Kaiser, race relations, the Philippines. There's lots of things he would comment on, be asked about, and not so much in the 1920s. And really no one knew who he was when he died.
As a historian, is he just kind of an interesting footnote to history, or are there other compelling reasons to know his story today?
I think he's more than a footnote. He's kind of a representative person of the time. I don't want to push that too hard because he was clearly an unusual guy. But in terms of his service in the war, his participation in the GAR, his extraordinary partisanship as a politician, his representative advocacy of reconciliation between the North and the South, really as a disabled person, he represents a number of very common types of people in the Gilded Age.
Well, James Martin, thank you so much for sharing this story, and hopefully it'll spur some interest in other stories like his.
Well, thank you very much.
James Martin's new book is called America's Corporal, James Tanner in War and Peace. It's published by the University of Georgia Press. Martin, who's chair of the history department at Marquette University, will talk about the book tomorrow evening at Boswell Book Company, and he spoke with Mitch Teich. Coming up next, The Little Engine That Could. Our auto contributor talks about Tesla Motor Company when we return. You're listening to Lake Effect from WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio. It's Lake Effect on Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Bonnie North. It is great to have your company today. In the early days of car manufacturing, both here and abroad, there were many more successful car makers than you might have imagined. It's only been in the past 50 years or so that American car manufacturers have shrunk to the big three. This is part of what makes the success of Tesla Motor Company so remarkable. Well, that and the fact that the company makes fully electric vehicles. So-called range anxiety, the fear that your electric car will run out of juice before you could find the next charging station, is something that isn't new. When Mercedes brought out its first electric production vehicle in 1906, concerns about how far it could go were what ultimately made car companies decide that gasoline-powered engines were the future. Well, Tesla is hoping to change that century-long trend, but as Lake Effect contributor Mark Savage tells Dan Harmon, they first need to address the public's safety concerns about possible electrical fires.
Yes, there's been two cases with Tesla, which is the electric car that's a luxury electric car out there and sells for $80,000 to $100,000. So, most of us would expect kind of perfection if we got a car in that price range, but they've only had two, as you say, out of about 20-some thousand vehicles that they've sold, that evidently road debris bounced up. The car, it rides a little lower than some cars. It is a sedan, and started battery fires. And as we talked about previously, recalls are a good thing if you get on top of things quickly. And while there's not a recall on these, they have said that there is a fix for this. They got a titanium shield to help block things from bashing into the batteries or, jumping up there and hitting them. And I guess they've done a reflash in the software so that it raises the car height a little bit so you have a little more ground clearance. So two possible fixes, and I guess I would give them credit. This is a small company as far as the number of vehicles that they've made, and they've only been around for a few years. And I give them credit for taking action quickly and finding a solution quickly. And part of that quickness, I would imagine, is because they're a small company and they don't have 27 layers to go through to get a fix on this. They went out and said, somebody, hey, work on this. We need it fixed now. So great. Great for them.
So much of their success depends on their image. Everything they do is being watched and scrutinized. So two fires, of course, that's, something that needs to be damage controlled. So it seems like unlike any other car company, they have to be on top of every single thing that happens.
Right. There have not been a lot of car companies start in the last, 50 years or so that started and made it. Most of the car companies around today have been around for 70, 80, 100 years. And newcomers are not welcome in this market. So with the electric car and battery, operated cars, they've got a different niche and they are high end. And yeah, they've got to keep their reputation clean and spotless. And, if you're charging that much, it's got to be a luxury image. And, you don't want to be in the shop and have a lot of problems with it. I know we have a local person here who's had some problems with their Tesla, who's, filed a lemon law complaint.
So not only do you expect perfection, if you will, in that price range, but do you expect really good customer service? And are they delivering that, do you think?
Well, I've heard that they've been doing real well, and I haven't heard of a lot of problems. Considering the small number that's out there, that may be part of it. And we all don't know someone who owns a Tesla at this point. I mean, you and I have talked to a gentleman that owns one, and he's been very happy with his. So I think that they're doing okay. It's just they don't have a dealership base because that's not how they sell their cars. So if they have a problem, I think they've got to jump on it quickly and get you directed to someone who can fix it right away.
And speaking of dealerships or lack thereof, they've lost one case, I believe, and I'm not sure what state it was. I won't even guess. But I know that they lost the challenge, which was that they are not going to be allowed to use their current model of selling their cars, which is basically online and then they deliver
right
in this particular state.
Right. There are some states that have laws. In fact, I think many of the states have laws against selling directly to the – a manufacturer selling directly to customers. So that's why, you know, Ford, Chevy, everybody has dealers out there that they sell the cars to, and then those people sell the cars to the customers. In theory, that's supposed to create more competition, and you know, I'm sure it does in many regards, but it also adds a middleman. So Tesla's idea is we don't need a middleman. We'll sell directly to customers and have it delivered to their homes or to a specific location, and you cut out the middleman. You can offer for less. Well, some of the argument is, well, there's no competition then. You know, it's you're controlling the entire market. I believe Texas, they're not allowed to sell cars directly. And I believe it was either New Jersey or New York that that's being challenged too. And, you know, and I understand if I'm a car dealer, I feel like, hey, somebody's got a brand new set of rules that they're going by, and that could be a problem. But unlike if Ford or GM decided that they were going to go direct to consumers, they don't have a contract with any, you know, Tesla doesn't have a contract with anybody saying, I'm going to sell to dealers. So now that's, you know, I'm messing up that contract. So I think it's an interesting concept, and it certainly goes along with today's marketplace. I mean, how many people buy things, whether it's from Amazon or eBay or, you know, online from a source, and you're not going to a department store, whatever the case may be, that maybe as a consolidator of all these products. So I think it fits in with today's marketplace. Legally, I don't know how long they'll be able to do this or whether it'll be or they can do it in 28 states but not others, you know. We'll have to wait and see. I think it's interesting, though.
Yeah, certainly is. I mean, what if they – I mean, I know this of course, would be an added expense for Tesla, but what if they just opened up a shop in these states? You know, they just had a storefront somewhere that is not a licensed – you know, not a dealership that's someone like a franchise, but Tesla still owns this dealership. So is that something they can do?
I don't know if that's, you know, and it probably varies by state again is how they've defined a dealership or a dealership network. You know, it may be that they end up with a one or two storefronts in a state. Out of Texas, they may need several just for delivery purposes. But, you know, in a smaller state, they may be able to set one dealership up, and whether that's owned by the company itself or a separate entity, I don't know what's going to work. But I think, you know, they've challenged the status quo, and I can guarantee you that in the car world, they've got a lot of dollars and attorneys looking to try and make this not happen.
All right. That's for sure, yes. Well, we just talked about their image. I mean, this to me, this couldn't be better PR depending on your views, but they're challenging the paradigm. They're challenging the powers that be. What could be better for their image than what they're doing right now?
Right. If you're the person who likes to be outside the box here and you appreciate both the fact that you have an electric car being offered to you with 200-mile range or so, 150 to 200-mile range, and that's different in and of itself. And now they're saying, hey, we're just trying to sell directly to our customers and save them money. And everybody's saying, no, we've got to add in another layer here so that there's more competition. I'm not sure that that will wash with today's consumer. So Tesla may be on, as you say, the right image side of this. I don't know legally how that'll work out, but on the image side, I think they're on the right. They're going the right way.
They've been out long enough for critics and everyone else involved to have a good idea about the car's reliability, longevity. Have they been proven enough at this point?
I would think another year or two will really help drive that home. I think they've had pretty good reliability and like I say, ownership satisfaction seems to be good. I know some of the car writers for major newspapers and magazines have certainly had Teslas. They haven't managed to get one out to Milwaukee, Wisconsin just yet. But
I'm sorry for you.
I'd be happy to test one if they're out there listening somewhere. I'd be happy to test that out for them and tell people my opinion. But I'm guessing another year to two before we have enough on the roads and also just some longevity. I mean, most cars you want to see a 2 or 3 year record of repairs and so forth.
And I would assume just from a consumer standpoint, I would guess 5 to 10 years.
Yeah. Well, yes. And they're talking about bringing out another model that would be more in that $40,000 price range. So now we're getting down to at least where a larger number, maybe not all of us, but a larger number of people could afford to buy one. So, yes, if you can have your top-of-the-line model doing well and having a good repair record, then you bring out the next one. That's going to help, you know, give you a little stronger leg to stand on from a quality standpoint. But once we get, let's say, 100,000 of these lower-cost ones on the road, then that will really have something to measure.
Now, is that the Model X, the kind of smallish SUV?
That's what they've been talking about bringing out next. And so, you know, SUVs also are so popular that that might give them a leg up on the marketplace too, just because people like the SUVs.
And speaking of the gentleman in Franklin who has filed basically a Lemon Law lawsuit against Tesla, any updates on that or any ideas on how Tesla is going to handle that?
No, I know they've had a response to it saying that they stand behind their cars, and that's great. That's all those things are worth what they're written on, I guess. But I haven't heard that he is – I know he's not dropping the lawsuit at this point, and I haven't heard that they've come up with a good solution. I think he asked them for a certain amount of money to buy the car back from him and kind of make him whole. So I'm guessing, again, that this will probably end up in the courts. And if I'm Tesla, though, I think I might just settle this one and move on and take the car back and see if there is something wrong with it. It appears it's been in the shop or out of service a number of days. So, you know, maybe it's a good time for them to regroup and say, hey, as we've talked about before, fess up. We had a problem with one car. Okay. We took it back. We made him whole. We'll fix it. Move on.
Yeah, would that be the, do you think, better customer and image relations move?
I would think that would be the better image move at this point, yes.
All right. Well, everything they do is interesting. I mean, it doesn't matter what it is because everything they do is sort of groundbreaking.
Well, yeah, I'm like you and I talked a little before. I think a lot of us are rooting for them to, you know, make a go of it. And because it's unusual to have a car maker come out with anything, whether it's a new design or just trying to, you know, keep cranking out internal combustion engine cars. And it's fun to see somebody trying some new and different things that will ultimately spur the marketplace forward and add some different models and some different, maybe capabilities as far as the battery range and so forth. So that's great.
Yeah, and then we can talk about the realities and the technicalities. But what's to me is also interesting is the big picture, which is technology and how will this country put its action where its mouths are? We like to think that we are cutting edge and we are into technology, and of course we are. But when we have a company like Tesla who is pushing boundaries, both technical and legal boundaries, and they're coming up against older paradigms and older ways of doing business, that is a whole other level that's interesting with this company.
Yes, and that's something that – and I'm guessing over the next 4 to 10 years we'll be finding out how that works out. But like I say, I think the fact that someone's challenging a lot of these paradigms, as you say, I think that's good, and it will push product forward. It's like anything else. Competition helps improve the lot for all of us, and maybe it's time for some changes and in the selling world of automobiles. Everybody has their opinions on I'm sure their car buying experience, and I think a lot of dealerships have worked a lot to improve those over the years. But who's to say I can't get on my computer and type in, hey, I want this car, and deliver it to my house.
All right. Just to follow up to the lawsuit, the local Lemon Law, I think one of the issues or legal issues around this and others around dealerships is that customers don't have legal recourse if there's no dealership, right? So, and that's been put out there in any number of places. So do you think that's legit, or do you think that's something that could just needs to be worked out in a different way?
Well, again, I think this may be something that needs legislation to probably change it if we're going to change it. If your law says you can only sue a dealer, then I guess, great for Tesla. They don't have anybody coming after them then. But if you have a problem, there's no recourse for the consumer. And, over the years, most of the time we've had consumer laws that will allow us to have some recourse against someone if we have a faulty product.
All right. I'm sure we'll be talking about Tesla again.
I hope so. And maybe next time we'll have to take a test drive.
All right. Well, be sure to stop by if you do.
Yes.
All right. Thanks, Mark.
Lake Effect contributor Mark Savage is the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel's auto writer. He's also associate publisher for four magazines at Waukesha's Kalmbach Publishing, American Snowmobiler, Classic Toy Trains, Fine Scale Modeler, and Scale Auto Magazine. He spoke with Dan Harmon. We'll take one last break, and then the quintessential Milwaukee cookbook, Recipes Fit for a Beer Garden. We'll hear about them when Lake Effect returns on Milwaukee Public Radio. Lake Effect continues on Milwaukee Public Radio now. I'm Bonnie North. It's finally good weather for dining al fresco, and Milwaukee offers plenty of opportunities for that, including the old standby, the Beer Garden. A recent cookbook by our very own Good Fermentations beer contributor Lucy Saunders offers some ideal suggestions for just that kind of occasion. The book is called Dinner in the Beer Garden, and Saunders features vignettes from beer gardens around the world. She joined Lake Effect's Eleanor Peterson in the studio and shared more of the story.
Beer gardens are a wonderful facet of enjoying life outdoors. And they started in Bavaria in Germany. And the tradition was to plant a chestnut tree near a brewery to help shade the cellars where the beer was kept aged. And it just naturally happened that people would gravitate towards the shade of the chestnut tree in order to enjoy a draft of beer at the brewery. And gradually, that became formalized and turned into parks with wonderful entertainment. And Milwaukee had a great history of really elaborate beer gardens at the turn of the century, and Prohibition kind of nixed that. We've been also blessed in the last couple of years because beer gardens are making an appearance again, and particularly in public spaces, which is, I think, a really important part of being in a beer garden is that it is an open and public space, unlike some of the more sheltered patios and outdoor gardens that are affiliated with restaurants.
So what is the star of the book? Beer, food, beer gardens, or all of the above?
I think that the answer is E, all of the above. And also, some of the stars of the book are some of the recipe contributors. For example, Vintage Brewing Company in Madison contributed a recipe for a really wonderful beet gnocchi in a Chèvre-Weiss beer sauce, which is pretty amazing. And we have some other additions and pairings. The Sprecher Brewery has a chocolate shortcake with burnt caramel cream that's paired with their award-winning Black Bavarian beer.
Ooh, so I'll need a recipe for that.
There's lots of choices. But unlike some of my past books, which focused on cooking with beer, this cookbook is all about pairing. And that's because I felt there wasn't a book on the market that addressed pairing beer with fruits and vegetables at the center of the plate. So all of these recipes, it's not a strictly vegetarian book. There are a few fish recipes as well as cheese and dairy. But it's one of those things where I think the mineral flavors in some vegetables can be a little tricky for wine, and beer with its malt sweetness and the kind of yeasty effervescence that it gets through fermentation can handle all of those flavors really, really well. So that's been a fun exploration in doing this cookbook, was really focusing on the pairings and fruits and vegetables.
Yeah, because what I've seen is, I was looking through the chapters, you have the cheese, the seafood, and the fruits, but I didn't see any burgers. So how would you describe the recipes that you included in this book? Are they more healthy? Are they light? Are they – where were you coming with this?
Well, the real play was on the word garden in the title, Dinner in the Beer Garden, because this really isn't a book about traditional beer garden fare like the, you know, hot dogs or burgers, as you point out. It's a cookbook for people who like carrots and kale, but also like fish and cheese and chocolate. So it's not – I was looking for pairings where the recipes would show the beer flavors to the – best possible light. And I think that's the real driver in choosing these recipes. And they're not complicated either. For example, one of the recipes that's great for this extended winter that we've had is is a udon with a ginger garlic broth. It's super easy. It's a pound of udon noodles cooked in 3 cups of vegetable broth. And you add roasted garlic and pickled ginger, some sliced green onions, and a garnish of toasted sesame seeds. Really easy. And you can also add other ingredients as well if you like, sliced shiitake mushrooms. And I thought a black IPA, for example, the Nuglaris Brewing Company has a wonderful black IPA called Blacktop that would go really well with this.
Mm. That's perfect, especially right before lunch here. So how do you go about pairing a dish that already has beer in it, like the famous Wisconsin beer and cheese soup? How do you go about pairing a dish like that?
Well, again, the flavors of the beer and the soup are subsumed, I think, mostly by the cheddar. There's a huge amount of cheese in the soup, so the total effect is very cheesy with a slight hint of beer at the end. And so I've liked to open it up for people to choose based on how aged the cheddar is. And I also have a couple of toppings that I suggest, popcorn, some additional grated cheddar that's been aged over hops. And I think that, you know, having an assortment of toppings can really change the direction of the pairing. And in culinary terms, that's a bridge. And a bridge pairing is one of those things where you're creating a flavor and an ingredient that is also highlighted in the beer style. And for the beer cheese soup, I'd suggested a red ale to kind of highlight the flavors of the cheese. But there's also an opposite direction you can take in this pairing, and you could use a smoked porter, which would really pick up some of the flavors of the chilies that I add to the base of the soup. So there's different directions that you can go with a pairing. And again, you can customize them to your taste. All of the pairing suggestions that I make in the cookbook, I really qualify it because every set of taste buds is different. Everybody's going to be more or less sensitive to certain flavors. You're going to see that particularly with an herb like cilantro, fresh cilantro leaves. For some people, it's piquant and a little minty and really enjoyable, and for other people it tastes just like soap. So you have to know your own taste buds and take the bridge pairings and garnishes in the direction that you want for your beer. And that requires tasting your beer and then creating a taste memory around it, thinking while you're tasting that beer, what would be good with this?
Well, Lucy Saunders, thank you so much for being here on Lake Effect.
Thank you so much, Eleanor.
Lucy Saunders is a Lake Effect contributor and the author of the cookbook Dinner in the Beer Garden. She first spoke with Eleanor Peterson in March. And that's all the time we have today. I'm Bonnie Knorr. Thanks, as always, for tuning in. We're looking forward to having you join us again tomorrow and every weekday morning at 10 for Lake Effect from listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio, NPR in Milwaukee. Stay tuned. Fresh air comes your way next. It's 11 o'clock.